From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Maryland's Commission on Medical Marijuana is still at least a month away from final regulations and taking applications, but a medical marijuana industry is beginning to take shape in the Free State as entrepreneurs who want to grow and sell cannabis look for a toehold. We talked to a state delegate and a reporter who's been covering it. Then, the role of citizens in preserving American freedom. We listen back to Tom Hall's talk with former Chief Judge of Maryland's highest court, Robert Bell, and historian and author, Dr. Jean Baker. Plus, our resident foodie, Sasha Wollhandler, gives us some great ideas about recipes that can make good use of all those zucchinis popping off the tables at area farmers markets. And the Environment in Focus with Tom Pelton. We start with news.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Good morning. Welcome to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Cancer or glaucoma patients in Maryland who hope to use marijuana to ease their symptoms are probably a year away from being able to fill a physician's prescription for it under the medical marijuana system set up by the state legislature. But as early as next month, the state's Medical Cannabis Commission could start taking applications for one of the 15 licenses to grow medical marijuana. Governing boards in several counties across the state already have been asked to approve zoning for medical marijuana factories. A medical marijuana industry is starting to take root in the Old Line State, and we thought it would be interesting to learn what kind of reception it's getting. With me in the studio is Michael Dresser, state government reporter for the Baltimore Sun, who's been covering some cannabis proposals in Western Maryland and the Eastern Shore. Welcome back to the show.
Happy to be here.
And joining us by phone is Delegate Dan Morheim, a Democrat who represents Baltimore County in the legislature. He's a medical doctor and was the chief sponsor of the medical cannabis law. Welcome back, Delegate Morheim.
Good to be with you both.
Michael, you went to Hagerstown, Washington County to check on the proposal of an outfit called Green Thumb Industries to build a medical marijuana production plant there. What did you learn?
Well, what I learned was that this company apparently has done a very good job of reaching out to the local governing authorities, the Board of Commissioners there, and making a case that it has a level of professionalism and the security in place so that its activities will not spill out into the community.
And so the Board of County Commissioners, all Republican?
Yes.
Voted?
Five Republicans voted unanimously to give their blessing to the proposal to put this growing and processing facility in an industrial park outside of Hagerstown. And it's well set off from any churches, homes, schools. I went out to the site, and it's pretty industrial. So,
but you reported this as if it was, you didn't think it would be a foregone conclusion that such a conservative county as Washington County would okay a production facility for medical cannabis.
Well, I talked with one of the commissioners there, and he said if you'd asked him 3 years ago whether he'd be voting in favor of a cannabis plant in the county, that he would have thought you were crazy. But opinions have really been changing fairly quickly on the whole question of medical cannabis. And even in conservative counties like Washington County, where many of the local lawmakers voted against the medical cannabis bill, now that it's been approved, they see a business opportunity and employment opportunities for their constituents.
You checked on a few other places. Is Washington County an exception?
No, not at all. I think there is some interest in Allegheny County, in Talbot County. There have been expressions of interest in Kent County. So it's not just, the urban areas of the state where there's some receptivity to this idea of a medical cannabis industry.
Delegate Morheim, under the first version of medical marijuana the legislature passed, am I right, that cannabis would have been produced by academic institutions, not by entrepreneurs.
No, that's not correct. They would have just been the research. But we've moved way past that. And to pick up a couple of things, first, thanks, Sheila, for mentioning patients at the beginning, because as much as we discuss the business side of this, let's not forget that there's, while this is, process has been going on for years now, 60,000 to 80,000 Marylanders who could benefit from medical cannabis. Children with seizures to people with cancer and multiple sclerosis have not been helped. Secondly, I would like to point out that the support for this has been overwhelmingly bipartisan. Typically, of the last 3 years, the votes in the Maryland General Assembly have been on the order of 188 legislators, somewhere on the order of 175 to 10 or less. And its bills have been signed by Governor O'Malley and Governor Hogan. I think what's going on at the local level is that the locals are beginning to catch up with the fact that the process is moving along, and businesses and dispensaries are coming. What they may not be fully aware of is that the legislation that was passed at the state level and signed by both governors and its strong support has a great deal of safety and security in it. There really is not any reason to impose any further restrictions, because the bills wouldn't have passed if there wasn't safety, security, avoidance of diversion, testing, background checks, all kinds of things, video cameras. If that wasn't in the original legislation, it wouldn't have passed. And the last thing I point, just to comment on something that Mike and you have both said, is that the national picture in this is changing. I was at the conference of the National Conference of State Legislators recently, and some people, you may have seen the article, that there was an overwhelming bipartisan vote, so strong that they didn't even bother doing just a voice vote, didn't even do a count, asking the federal government to change its laws, reschedule marijuana from a Schedule One drug, which is all danger and no benefit, to something more reasonable, and do research and also allow for the bank federal banking laws to change, which is an impediment to this process.
That's State Delegate Dan State Delegate Dan Morheim, a Baltimore County Democrat who sponsored the medical marijuana law here on Maryland Morning, WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also here with me in the studio is Michael Dresser, state government reporter for the Baltimore Sun. We're talking about the first steps of a medical marijuana industry in Maryland.
We're going to call it medical cannabis. That is the proper term now in the state law. It's called cannabis, which is a scientific term, and maybe a little less pejorative than marijuana. This is a medicine now, and that's what we're looking at it.
I want to pick up on your point about the relation with the federal government, because, am I right, something like half the states and the District of Columbia have okayed medical cannabis, but it's growing marijuana still remains, and distributing it still remains illegal under federal law. In what way does that cast a cloud on this?
Well, you're right. More than half the U.S. population now lives in a medical cannabis state, and even Louisiana passed legislation that Governor Jindal signed just a few weeks ago, just to show you how well accepted this is. There are federal barriers. There have been some changes. Some research impediments to research, which is really should have been happening all along for the last 50 years, have been removed. In bipartisan votes, the Congress, which doesn't usually agree on anything, given their gridlock, but in bipartisan votes, the Congress has voted to not allow funding for DEA activities, drug enforcement activities, to prosecute people using medical cannabis in states where they're following their own state's medical cannabis laws. Nonetheless, the system is, there are inconsistencies because of this conflict between state and federal law. And that was one other thing that the National Conference of State Legislators, this bipartisan group, asked for, is that the federal government just let the states do what they want.
But is it clear to you whether the entrepreneurs we've been talking about in Maryland will be able, for example, to use federally chartered banks to handle their finances?
That's definitely a problem, and that is one of the problems. In other states, that is an inconsistency here that needs to be fixed, and the way it's been approached in other states is not entirely satisfactory, but it's been through state chartered banks and credit unions, and that might be what will happen here, but we don't know yet.
State law envisions 15 growing facilities, but a lot more dispensaries of medical cannabis, as many as 94, two in each legislative district. Michael Dresser, do you expect rural areas to be as relaxed When those proposals start coming forth?
Proposals
for dispensaries?
No, I don't. I think that the growing facilities are easy to remove from visibility.
As you described the one in
Hagerstown. And you can locate these off in an industrial park or as in Easton, recycle, you know, where the proposal is to recycle an old Black & Decker plant. With dispensaries, they are retail outlets by definition, and they are going to want to locate in retail areas with some visibility. And
well,
let me
interrupt, Michael. It's retail, but it's not open for general distribution. It's only for those patients and those doctors who have gone through the commission process. It's like getting a prescription filled. You can't walk into a pharmacy and get any prescription filled just by asking. This is not a liquor store. This is a medical distribution center, and it operates very much like a pharmacy, very much in parallel, and that's how the bill was designed. So it's not really retail in the sense of open to the public.
I understand that,
Dan,
but I think if you're operating a dispensary, you're not going to be want to be shoved off into some area, and I think you're already seeing in Baltimore County some talk of legislation that could push these facilities into remote places.
Let me just zip in there and see. As I understand it, County Councilwoman Vicky, I'm sorry, I'm blanking. Vicky Almond is proposing legislation to give the county control over where dispensaries would be located. And State Senator Bobby Zirkin is already saying that he, the chair of the Senate Judicial Proceedings Committee, is saying he would put forth legislation to make sure that the dispensaries are not blocked by counties.
I think what people need to appreciate is that the dispensary will be operating very much like a pharmacy, that the state law has a great deal of security and accountability within dispensaries. There are going to be video cameras. There will be physical barriers. There will be all kinds of protection. So there's really no reason to have any county restriction. I think just a lot of county officials are not aware of the state law because they really haven't had to focus on it yet. But when they look at it and they realize the bipartisan vote, the number of issues that were addressed in state law, they'll relax. You certainly don't want
to
put a barrier to people getting
Delegate
medicine.
Moreham.
That's the key thing. You don't want barriers for people getting medicine, and that's what this is.
Thank you both. We're flat out of time. I appreciate your coming in. Michael Dresser, state government reporter for the Baltimore Sun. State Delegate Dan Moreham, a Baltimore County Democrat and medical doctor, sponsor of the medical marijuana law. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead, reflecting on the duties of citizenship. Stay with us on 88.1.
If you have thoughts on that segment you just heard, email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We're at Maryland Morning. Now back to the show.
Morning, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Last week, we celebrated the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act, which President Lyndon Johnson signed into law on August 6, 1965. We thought it would be nice to revisit a conversation I had last January with Judge Robert Bell and the historian Gene Baker. Voting is, of course, the fundamental right of citizens and the essential ingredient of a democracy. Judge Bell and Dr. Baker talked about the role that citizenship plays in preserving freedom in America. We spoke in advance of a panel they were serving on in January at the Benjamin Banneker Historical Park and Museum. Judge Robert M. Bell is the former chief judge of the Maryland Court of Appeals. He served in that position from 1996 until 2013, culminating a nearly 40-year career on the bench. Dr. Jean Baker is an historian and the author of many books on 19th century American history. She taught at Goucher College for many years on their Towson campus, and she continues to teach in Goucher's prison education program. So, Your Honor, let me start with you. In your personal experience, your incredible life and career, you were 16 years old. You and some fellow students sat down at a place called Hooper's Restaurant, asked to be served lunch. You were refused. This is in 1960. Mm-hmm. You were convicted of a crime. That case went all the way up to the Supreme Court, where you were exonerated. Mm-hmm. 9 years later, a year after Dr. King was assassinated, you graduated from Harvard Law School and began your legal career. What does citizenship mean to you?
Well, it means the life of the nation itself, because without people being able to understand the interrelationship between the branches of government themselves, then we're not likely to have any semblance of good government, or at least we're not going to have government to the extent that we're going to be able to feel comfortable that the decisions that are being made in the public interest.
And Dr. Baker, what do you think the basic tenets of good citizenship are?
Well, certainly voting. Certainly following the rules of the nation. And I would also include supporting the ideals of America. It does seem to me that we've had an erosion of some of the characteristics that are important for citizenship. People don't vote anymore. People don't read newspapers anymore. And it may be old-fashioned to try to look to a previous era for some kinds of rejuvenation of citizenship, but the kinds of things that we can do to improve citizenship remain beyond my comprehension.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Judge, just yesterday, the state of Arizona, which ironically was the last state to recognize the Dr. King holiday, they did about 6 years later than anybody else, but they were the first state to pass a law that requires high school seniors to pass a civics test as a condition of graduation.
I applaud it.
Is citizenship something that can be taught? Because it used to be taught all the time.
Of course it can be taught. And in fact, I think we ought to spend a good deal more time trying to teach it now because, as Dr. Baker said, we don't read. We listen to our politicians who tell us what the relationship between themselves and ourselves and the society is, and they accept it without realizing that in many instances it's not true. I think that we ought to have, as we did when I was in school, classes on citizenship so we understand how the local government works, how the state government works, and how the federal government works, and how they interrelate with each other, and more importantly, what our role is in that system, what our responsibilities are, not only what we get from it, but what we owe to it. And if we had that, I think we'd be in much better shape than we are today.
Yeah, it's been since the 1950s and 1960s, Gene Baker, that citizenship was actually taught. I studied it in school as an elementary school kid. The three of us did, you know. Mm-hmm. But I wonder, as a historian of the 19th century in particular, has there been an evolving, changing notion of what citizenship means between the 19th, the 20th, and now the 21st century?
I think I can go back even farther to the colonial period, where the idea of a good citizen was one who supported founding fathers. Very few people could vote, but nonetheless, you supported what came down from the hierarchy. And then in the 19th century, we have a really engaged electorate. They prayed. They dressed up in costumes. Mm-hmm. The turnouts were 70%. 60%, I think, the year that Abraham Lincoln was elected. But guess what? Half the population couldn't vote. Right. Yeah. And so, as Judge Bell knows better than I, the 14th Amendment was really the first time that we had this national definition of what citizenship was. And it was a status. All persons born and naturalized in the United States. But guess what? For women, That did not include voting. Mm-hmm. So citizenship is, it's a very ephemeral kind of thing, and it changes over time. And as you suggest, by the time we get to the 20th century, we have classes. I would date them, by the way, from the 1920s, when women finally get the vote. I think some Americans think, hey, we better teach these women what it is that they're to do as citizens. And now we have only the state of Arizona, apparently, going to have citizenship.
Because most of those classes ended about in the 1960s, interestingly, at a time in our country, Judge, when there was amazing participation in the political process. Dr. King is, you know, a great exemplar of that. I mean, let's talk about voting. From your position, you know, as a scholar of the law and as a judge for so many years, as Gene Baker suggests, I mean, in 2008, when President Obama was elected for the first time, 5 million more voters voted that year than in the previous presidential election, but it was still about only just under 62%. Right. In 2014, here we have the 50th anniversary of Freedom Summer, ironically, 36.4% of eligible voters voted in the United States of America. From your position, how do you explain that? Is that part of, is that a consequence of the paucity of civics education?
Oh, I think it's part of that, but I think it also has to do with some expectations that have not been met. And folk will respond to that by inactivity, not realizing that the inactivity really exacerbates the problem. It's also, I think, has to do to some extent with the efforts on the part of some to reduce the ability of certain members of the electorate to vote. And people buy into it because they don't really understand, I think, to some extent, the full extent of the power that they have should they exercise that right.
Judge Robert M. Bell is the former chief judge on the Maryland Court of Appeals. Gene Baker is an historian on the faculty of Goucher College. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Maryland Morning with Sheila Cass. We're talking about citizenship and its relationship to preserving freedom in an American democracy. So, Gene Baker, is the unique nature of this American experiment, this democracy we have, where the individual is celebrated and elevated in so many ways. Is there a natural tension then between individual rights and the rights and the responsibilities of the citizenry as a whole?
Yeah. I think some political scientists would argue that we now have a new kind of citizenship. It's based on individuals who monitor their rights. They become interested in community issues when there's something in their individual lives that is either attacked or challenged. But Tom Hall and Judge Bell, you know, we live in this society that is a me society. Mm-hmm. I remember being in a bookstore and seeing, I think this is about 10 years ago, a magazine, and the title was Me. I was astonished. And we don't have any us now. So what we have are individuals who are citizens in terms of that status and who really project their interests into the public domain by focusing on whatever it is, gun rights, etc.
Well, that's right. You know, it's interesting. That's because they don't understand the totality, or don't choose to understand the totality of what it means to be a citizen. You can cherry pick all you want, but the bottom line is, at the end of the day, we're all in this thing together, and those decisions that we make must benefit us all, at least to some extent, otherwise we're going to have a failed society. And those folk are following the lead, I'm afraid, of a number of our politicians who choose to cherry pick the issues and present them to a certain base. And that base is what reacts.
Yeah, and so one could make the argument then that this political polarity that we've had, this bifurcation of views and, you know, the good guys and the bad guys and everybody divided into these camps, that's really gnawing away at the very heart of citizenship itself.
I think that's right. I think that's right. And what I think I find most discouraging is that people are not calling it the way it is. When you have some of these issues that come up, and you have this side saying A and this side saying B. Nobody ever says, wait a minute, that's antithetical to the public good. That piece of it is missing. And it's missing, I suspect, because neither side wants to cede to the other side an interest in the general public.
I'm Tom Hall on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. We're listening to a conversation I had last January with Judge Robert Bell, the former chief judge on the Maryland Court of Appeals, and Dr. Gene Baker from Goucher College. We spoke about the pervasive influence of money in American politics and how that money is concentrated in the hands of very few people. In the 2012 election, almost three-quarters of the PAC money raised by candidates from both parties came from only about 100 people. I asked Judge Bell if the kind of political movement led by Dr. King in the 1960s has been replaced in our time by money.
Well, I guess the easy answer to it is yes. You're absolutely right. The public's involvement is in many ways manufactured, basically, because the money generates a lot of the activity. I'd like to see us go back to the day when we had students, preachers, ordinary people being engaged because they felt strongly about an issue.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to see that day come back. And part of it, I guess, you're beginning to see some of it with the protests in regard to Garner and Ferguson and those sorts of things. That's a good sign from my perspective, because it shows that these people are engaged in some issue that really has some public interest in it.
In 1816, about 40 years into the nation-American experiment, Thomas Jefferson wrote, "If a nation expects to be ignorant and free, it expects what never was and never will be." We've been listening to a conversation about citizenship recorded earlier this year with Judge Robert Bell and the historian Gene Baker. Judge Bell was the chief judge on the Maryland Court of Appeals from 1996 until 2013. Gene Baker is an historian and the author of many books about 19th century American history. They appeared together on a panel entitled "The Role of Citizenship in Preserving American Freedom." It was held at the Benjamin Banneker Historical Park and Museum in Catonsville on January 7th. We first broadcast this conversation the day before. We've got a link to more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
Is there an issue you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or leave us a voicemail at 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. Again, that's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Time now for What You Got Cooking.
Say hey. Got cooking. How's about cooking something up with me?
And as always, we are joined by our resident foodie, Sasha Wolfhandler, who, along with her husband Steve Sisser, runs Sasha's 527 Restaurant and Catering on Charles Street. Hey, Sasha, how you doing?
Hey, great, Tom. How are we doing in this hot August?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, terrific. And, of course, this is prime season for the farmers markets. They've been just, you know, bursting at the seams with stuff for the last couple of months. Today we're going to talk about lots of new things to do with zucchini, one of my faves.
I tell you, the zucchini, she's a loose vegetable.
Loose vegetable, is she? I didn't realize there was a moral code for the vegetables
well,
at the farmer's market.
Well, she just goes any which way you want her to, and I love that about the girl. She is great. Our zucchini, I mean, you can grill her. You can eat her raw. You can put her, you know, she's great in just if you're having people over for cocktails and you're making a great crudité. Zucchini with a little bit of sea salt on it in a dip is just wonderful. You can grill the zucchini, which we'll talk about in a minute. You can steam it. You can saute it for in endless different ways. You can bake with it. So when I said she's loose,
yep.
We so go every which
we
way.
We go
with
every
her.
Which way. All right, so right. Let's talk about a couple of ways. Now, for example, when you grill zucchini, I usually just brush a little olive oil, a little salt and pepper, and stick it right on the grill.
That is all you have to do. You want to cut it a little bit thicker just because, you know, it's going on the grill and you don't want it to fall. So many of my vegetables, even though I have one of those baskets, some of them, I don't know, they always end up in the fire. What is that problem all about, Tom? But so you cut them a little thicker, folks, and olive oil on it, just as Tom had said, they are so delicious that way. And when they come off, a good splash of balsamic or nothing. They are just wonderful grilled. What I also brought, fried zucchini. I'm telling you, fried zucchini. Remember, Tom, in the 80s, dating us a little bit, we all ate that fried zucchini.
When we were able to eat fried zucchini. My wife and I, Linnell Smith and I, our dating life began eating fried zucchini at a place on Calvert Street, the name of it, which is escaping me right now.
I mean,
and they had great fried zucchini and fried onions and stuff. We had a great time.
I mean, frito misto of vegetables. It's just every once in a while you have to let yourself indulge in a little fried food. And what I did here, and you can see they're like little zucchini chips, I had some egg, and I dipped my zucchini because you need the glue. And then I had panko crumbs, those great mm-hmm. bread crumbs that the Japanese have brought over to our world. And I also put in a bunch of Italian seasonings in there.
Oh, it's delicious.
Aren't they delicious?
I
had
that.
Some little garlic powder, and I had some onion powder, and I had that trilogy of thyme, basil, and oregano. You can't miss.
Yeah.
And then some Parmesan cheese in that. I know it's a lot of stuff, folks, but it's also, it's very lightly breaded. I just dipped it in it, and then I put it in about an inch of grapeseed oil or whatever oil you're frying in, and just turn them for a second. You can't make enough of them. People will just
right.
eat them and
yeah.
eat them
these,
and eat
these
them.
These will disappear.
They
quickly.
Were
yeah,
so, they are so, so delicious. Alternatively, on the other side of that plate, for those of you who don't want to fry anything, I kind of roasted some zucchini in the oven, and I cut them a little too thinly because they're a little mushy, but I did the same procedure. I put them in some bread. I put them in egg, and then I put them in breadcrumbs with that same trilogy of different herbs that I talked about earlier, and then I baked them. But what would be wonderful with that is to
really
make
yeah.
is to make a zucchini like we do with eggplant parmesan. Do that as a zucchini parmesan, which mm-hmm. would be totally wonderful. Really, really great.
Yeah, good stuff. There's one here that looks like you've made the zucchini into a pasta substitute.
Well, it's amazing. There are these things called, I think they're called zoodlers or noodler. They're these new apparatus. You can buy them inexpensively, medium expense, or very expensively. They're in a lot of your, near the produce market or the grocery stores. For zucchini, and you can't use the big ones. You put them through, and it comes out like beautiful, beautiful, beautiful ribbons that look like long, gorgeous pasta. And I am telling you, those of you that are trying to still get into the perfect bikini at the end of August for that little last Labor Day weekend that you want to have and you want to get a few pounds off, I am telling you, this yeah. is a wonderful way to eat all your pasta sauces. I did it two different ways there. I have some mandarin oranges and some peanuts, and I put that all with a Szechuan vinaigrette on it. Isn't that?
Oh, it's delicious.
Isn't that? And it's so refreshing. What a great
way. It kind of reminds me, you know, you could do spaghetti squash.
You
like
could
this.
Use
you could, you put stuff on top of spaghetti squash
it's
instead
the same,
of on pasta.
It is the same, essentially
but
the same
principle.
But you can
make zucchini into the basis of what you're
and
doing
And if you
here.
Don't have one of those noodler machines, you can use your julienne blade on your Cuisinart. You can also use the julienne blade on the mandolin.
And you got a couple of zucchini fritters, it looks like.
I have
as well.
Zucchini fritters. I know last month we talked about the corn pancakes. Zucchini pancakes are kind of almost the same thing. You want to take your flour and your shredded zucchini, and I put a little bit of shredded onion in there and salt and pepper, a tiny bit of baking powder, just give it a little airiness, and fried those up. I put a little bit of chipotle sauce on top of that.
There's a little kick to it.
Little kick at the end. They make a perfect transporter for any kind of little shrimp on top of it with some sauce or a little bit of crab meat on top of it, or keep it all vegetarian. Is that not great with a summer cocktail at the end of the day?
Terrific.
Totally wonderful. I mean, there's so many things you can do with zucchini. You can make zucchini slaw, people. You can do, and of course, we all know about zucchini muffins and zucchini bread. Use your zucchinis, fall in love. It's an endless summer of zucchini.
I want to talk about one other thing, a Provençal chicken and zucchini and corn dish that you have talked about. I haven't had it yet, but it sounds really
well. You know, we've had the reason we've had such a great summer of vegetables here in the East. I hate to talk about this because our poor Californian friends are suffering, but we've had a lot of great rainstorms and we've also had some great hot days. It seems as if we've had the perfect balance. But some of those rainstorms have happened when I was having some folks over to dinner and it's torrential rains and suddenly my barbecue is not looking so great. Easy, easy peasy thing to take your roasting pan, take whatever chicken parts you want, dust them in a little salt and pepper and flour, put a whole bunch of olive oil, a couple of good squirts of whatever great olive oil in the bottom of your roasting pan. Put your chicken in there. Put in some chopped up about 10 cloves of garlic. Put in your some chopped up shallots and then two or three or four onions, lemons, and cut them into quarters or eighths with the rind and everything. Just big chunks of lemon. And then throw a whole bunch of herbs de Provence. If you don't have herbs de Provence, make your own. Do the thyme, do the basil, do the garlic powder, do the fresh parsley, tons and tons of it. You can't put enough of these herbs on it. Throw the whole thing in the oven for 45 minutes to an hour at 425. At half an hour, toss it all around and then put your little corn cobs in there and your chunks of zucchini. Add that to the whole mix and you will have a one-pot dinner that is sumptuous. All you need is to bring it out in the roasting pan. It looks gorgeous. It smells gorgeous. The zucchini is fervent. The corn is beautiful. The chicken is succulent. Pull out the rosé and pretend you're in the south of France.
There you go. Not hard to do when you're cooking. That sounds like a great idea. Sasha, always good to see you. Thank you so much.
Happy August.
Sasha Wollhandler and her husband Steve Sisser run Sasha's 527 Restaurant and Catering on Charles Street. Come to WIPR.org/Maryland Morning and we'll have recipes for the great zucchini dishes that Sasha told us about this morning. On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for being with us. Have a great day.
Maryland Morning is an original production of Your Public Radio,
WYPR, in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Johnny McCone
and Connor Graham.
We have production help from
Christy Forrest
and Scott Seiss.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. Tomorrow is August 13th. On that day in Maryland history, 1892, the first issue of the Baltimore Afro-American hit the streets. John Henry Murphy Sr., a former slave, merged three church publications to form the Afro. By his death in 1922, it was the most widely circulated black newspaper on the Atlantic coast and reached even greater national prominence under the 45-year editorship of his son, Carl Murphy. We're back on Friday. Please join us.